There's so many stigmas and taboos that surround this topic. And if you can't talk openly about it, then you can't talk about the solutions and what needs to be done and get that return on investment and convince investors to actually put their money into these new innovative women's health solutions.
Welcome to AI for Pharma Growth, the podcast from pioneering pharma artificial intelligence entrepreneur, Dr. Andre Bates. This show aims to demystify AI for all those in biopharma, from startup biotech right through to big pharma. Each episode focuses on all things AI and future tech related to help pharma execs to navigate through the and benefit from the sometimes confusing but magical world of AI-powered tools to grow and get real-world results.
Today's episode is about how AI can be leveraged in femtech and women's health. Femtech is technology around female health, and femtech companies can be designated as tech-enabled solutions addressing women's health, excluding biopharma and incumbent medical devices. And femtech provides a wide range of solutions to improve healthcare for women. So it is across a number of female-specific conditions, such as maternal health, menstrual health, pelvic and sexual health, fertility, menopause, and contraception, but also across general health conditions where there is disproportionately more women than men with the condition. My guest today is Bethany Corbin, who is the founder of Fem Innovation, which seeks to disrupt standard care delivery for women's health through legal and educational programs, thought leadership, and advocacy. She has been named a top 200 trailblazing leader in women's health and femtech. She won the 2023 Champion in Healthcare Award, and her insights have been featured in top news outlets, including Forbes, Fortune, NPR, BBC, Cosmopolitan, Teen Vogue, and many more. She's also testified before congressional bodies. That's quite a list of achievements there. Really happy to have you on the show, Bethany.
So happy to be here. Thank you for having me. I'm really excited for the discussion we're going to have today.
Me too. Let's start with you telling, because you've got so much going on here. Can you tell me a little bit about your background and how you got into this and what led you to Fem Innovation?
Absolutely. So it's an interesting background because I definitely didn't start in this field. And I was somebody who came out of college and really didn't know what they wanted to do other than being an attorney seemed like a really good idea. And so whenever I first went into the field of law, I was actually doing things like financial services, construction law, appellate litigation law, and absolutely hated it. I didn't feel like I was making a difference in any way to society or to the community. I started to really think about what I was passionate about and came to find that I really liked healthcare. We had been involved with the healthcare community and the healthcare system since I was about 7 with my mom's illness. And we were, unfortunately, some of those people that were gaslit in the medical communities. My mom was told it was all in her head whenever she was seeking a diagnosis. And it took us 7 to 8 years to get her a diagnosis. And so I thought that was a space where I could make a meaningful difference. So I went into healthcare law, did the traditional big law work in Washington, D.C., worked for judges, and ended up going in-house at a law school to work as a law professor. And during that time, I just happened across the word femtech in some other unrelated legal research and actually became really interested in it, started digging deep, and I realized that nobody in the legal field was talking about this. It was really new at the time. And then I said, that's really interesting. I think I can have more of an impact than what I'm having as just a teacher at a law school. I want to actually help startup companies. So I went back into healthcare and unfortunately had my own women's health experience. And, it was one of those things that was diagnosed at a routine annual exam, and you're kind of thrust into having to navigate your own healthcare, journey, framework, symptoms, disease, treatment, all of that. And so I really started to become acquainted with the women's health field at that time. And what I learned was really shocking, right? It was that 70% of women were going to have a similar condition to what I had. There had been very little innovation in this space. They still didn't know what was causing this type of an illness. And after all of that, I thought, we've got to do better for women. So I really pivoted my career at that point in time to actually focusing on and helping women's health innovators in this field. And that's how I came up with Fem Innovation, which is just really designed to push the women's healthcare agenda forward.
Oh, wow. And how do you do that? So tell me more about Fem Innovation.
Yes. Yeah, so FemInnovation is a relatively new company. We operate on four platforms or four pillars. So the first is we provide legal and strategic business guidance to founders in this space. So anybody who's looking to come and innovate in women's healthcare, we offer our legal and our business strategy services. Our second pillar is really helping to bridge the tech founder and clinician gap. Because what I've learned by working with so many startups in this field is that oftentimes there's not a lot of medical oversight over the tech solutions that are coming and helping to revolutionize women's healthcare. And it's not for a lack of interest from OBGYNs and doctors and scientists in this field. It's just that there's actually a huge gap. And so we're really trying to facilitate and bridge collaboration and mend that gap between the tech founders and the clinicians. Nice. Our third pillar is really focused on education. So educating the general public about women's healthcare, because there's so many stigmas and taboos that surround this topic. And yeah. If you can't talk openly about it, then you can't talk about the solutions and what needs to be done and get that return on investment and convince investors to actually put their money into these new innovative women's health solutions. Yeah. So that's our third pillar. And then our fourth is really trying to influence where we're going from a legislative and political perspective on women's health, and doing that through some thought advocacy and helping to bring perspective to some of the new laws that are coming into play and thinking through what they might be missing when we think about women's health within the broader context of digital health.
Wow, interesting. There's so many facets in that as well with pharma, because a lot of drugs are really focused on, you know, because the clinical trials tend to be white men, basically, yes. Because of fears of, I guess, you know, birth defects, etc. But at the same time, I remember reading how, you know, heart attacks in women are very, very different symptoms yes. to heart attacks in men, and often get missed because of that difference. So, yeah, it's very interesting.
Yeah, they really do. And that's, to be honest, really kind of what led to the creation of femtech in the first place as an industry. I mean, it's a relatively new industry coined in about 2016. And it emerged because of exactly what you said. We have an underrepresentation of women in mainstream modern medicine. Yeah. All of the insights that we have are based on male physiology, right? With the assumption that they can be applied to women and our only differences are our reproductive organs, which yeah. as we know, right, is not true, as you were just talking about with the heart attacks.
Yeah.
And because of that, right, we see things like women having 50 to 75% more adverse reactions when they take prescription drugs, or women's heart attacks being missed, you know, with their different symptoms, 50% of the time are having a higher death rate 5 years after being diagnosed with a heart attack. Yeah. And so we've really learned, right, that modern healthcare isn't built for women. Yeah. And a large part of that comes down to the fact that we don't even have data on women's health because so many conditions haven't been studied.
Yeah. Well, they've been studied, but only with men.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's funny you mentioned that, because there was this egregious example. I can't remember if it was like 1960s or 1980s, where they wanted to study, you know, the impacts of hormones on breast and uterine cancer. And yeah. they enrolled zero women in the study. It was all based on men. So that's exactly right. That's the kind of data that we have for women's health.
How did they get data on uterine health out of men?
Exactly.
That's a very interesting question. I would love to read that.
I mean, just think of all the ways that was flawed just from the outset. And yet that's the data we have to drive women's health innovation.
It's crazy. I mean, it's great that you're shining a light on it, actually, because, you know, we know about it, but you don't see that many people really making it much more public about what's going on.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're starting to gain some traction in terms of talking about women's health more publicly. But there's still so many barriers and such an uphill battle that women's health faces, whether it's in, you know, the pharma industry, whether it's whenever we're talking about pitching to investors, you know, or even just advertising products on social media. It's kind of at each turn, right, there's additional barriers that you know, men's health or other types of healthcare don't have to contend with.
Yeah, exactly. Wow. Well, what I'd really love to get into with you is AI and how AI is being used in the femtech industry for women's health.
Yeah, no, there's actually been a ton of different applications of AI for women's healthcare. It's interesting, you know, to see the applications of these. Some are in, you know, fields that may not drive as meaningful change as other fields, but there's a couple of key areas. So first, you know, the one that kind of often comes to mind is when you think about AI is all the innovations you're hearing about in breast cancer. Mm-hmm. So there's been a couple of different companies and a couple of different platforms that are coming through to use AI to detect breast cancer in women. So for instance, 2021, Roche partnered with Microsoft actually on a tool that can use AI and cloud technologies to improve breast cancer diagnoses in the Middle East. The tool had, you know, AI algorithms in it that were based on some previous data assessments for mammograms, and they were actually able to identify the location of the breast cancer and also calculate the abnormality score. And it had about a 96% accuracy rate, which was pretty incredible.
Yeah.
And when we look, you know, DeepMind, which was acquired by Google, they're also a leader whenever it comes to this space on really looking at how we can use AI to have higher, you know, detection rates for radiologists when they're looking at the mammograms. So there's also been, you know, researchers at MIT who are creating deep learning algorithms that are able to read mammograms just as well as doctors. White Rabbit is a company as well that had developed a new tool that used AI-powered services to make it easier for patients to even go and schedule their breast cancer screenings, and also had kind of a, I think it was called WR Density software, which just got FDA 510K approval in the US. And what that does is it can provide objective data to radiologists to really help them identify that level of breast density, which, as we know now, correlates with a higher risk of breast cancer. So that's kind of what we think about in breast cancer space that's going on right now. We also see it in the maternity space. So there have been some new studies and some new products coming out that are really looking at developing AI technology to calculate women's risks of preeclampsia. There have been some researchers who are also doing a study on AI and how it can be used to better, you know, reduce and identify the risks that individuals, particularly Black women, are facing during their pregnancy journey, because they do typically have higher mortality rates given the systemic bias that has existed within the systems. There have been, you know, Ascertain is another one that's using algorithmic technology to look at predicting preeclampsia. And really, their AI algorithm actually had a 10 to 15 fold increase over the current predictive standard for preeclampsia. So that was really cool. You know, the other types of things that we're seeing, reproductive health. Flow, which is probably one of the most well-known femtech products out there, period ovulation tracking app, they actually have an AI-powered women's health platform that can provide these cycle predictions, provide these personalized daily health insights, and also access to a community. And so it can use that AI to give you those more accurate predictions. Similarly, there's been AI and machine learning with respect to things like polycystic ovary syndrome. So there's been some new diagnostic platforms coming out that use AI that can diagnose and classify PCOS a couple of years before they would otherwise be diagnosed using traditional mainstream medicine. Embryos are another really cool thing that we're seeing for women's health. So there have been some AI technologies being used to actually, they're being trained, right, on images of embryos, right, good, you know, viable embryos and also diseased embryos. And one of the new studies showed that this AI algorithm could actually identify high and low quality embryos with about 97% accuracy, and that it was actually outperforming trained embryologists in this field. So that's been really cool to watch. Things like urinary tract infections. So there's a company called MyUTI on the market today that actually uses AI to analyze the urine sample that you have, if you, you know, suspect you might have a UTI or a chronic UTI, and to determine based on the bacteria which drug might be the best fit for you for actually tackling and remedying your UTI. So that has also been really exciting to see. One of the coolest ones that I think is out there now too is, well, you know, has been in development, is actually a smart tampon. So that seems to use AI applications to test for cervical cancer, because women.
Sorry, it just reminded me, I did a show with a doctor a few weeks ago, And he said what he's waiting for is a tampon that does, he said, we just need a tampon. We don't need to do the pap smear. You could actually get it from a tampon. It would get a lot more screening done because women would do it themselves and send it in. So it's actually happening. This is amazing.
It is. Yeah. It was actually developed by a team of, you know, graduate students. So it hasn't come on the market yet, but their research and what they've built is incredible because it's just, you know, designed to be and feel like a regular tampon. And yet it's got this really cool high sensor camera at the end that can take pictures and use AI to screen that against, you know, abnormal looking cells that it has been trained against in the algorithmic technology. And, you know, tell you if something looks off and you should see your doctor. But as you mentioned, right, that's crucial for enhancing the number of women who are going to get screened for cervical cancer, because right now with the pap smear, people aren't going to get, you know, you're supposed to get it every 3 years, but so many women don't because it's uncomfortable, it's painful, they might feel embarrassed. So that's one of the ones I'm really excited about.
What's the name of it?
It's just called the Smart Tampon right now.
The Smart Tampon. I am going to let that doctor know because that was his brainchild. He didn't know it was being developed.
yeah, it is. And it's, you know, by an academic team, actually. So it's really cool to see the impact that kind of the younger generation is already having on women's health technology.
That is really interesting. Wow. What about, you know, it's interesting because I didn't realize this huge range of applications that you had. The ones that I saw a lot of were the oncology ones. And I have seen often, you know, top oncologists pitted against AI. The AI always does better in terms of accuracy because they've seen, you know, the AI has been trained on millions of cases and the oncologists may not have as many as the AI.
Absolutely.
But it's nice to see this much broader range of applications coming through.
Yeah, it's huge. You know, I do think that the cancer, you know, oncology cancer field is definitely the most ripe whenever we think about women's health for uses of AI. But even things, you know, like menopause, I've seen more and more platforms come out to use AI to provide personalized treatment recommendations for menopause. There's one actually, it's called Midday, and it is a collaboration between Lisa Health and the Mayo Clinic. And it's using artificial intelligence and digital therapeutics to revolutionize menopause management. So that is also pretty new and something, you know, that I would say wouldn't have existed, you know, back in 2016, whenever we were just getting into femtech.
That's interesting because I ran this AI and pharma event about 2 months ago. And after I sort of told everyone about, you know, what AI is and gave use cases, I got everyone into groups and it was just women. It was just a group of women because I ran to Chief. So it was kind of a female only event.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Very familiar with Chief.
Yeah. And so, well, I got them to come think of a problem in their life and come up with an AI solution. And one of them said that with COVID, everyone got their medical records. And she said for years she'd been going to doctors with these weird symptoms and they kept saying to her, no, nothing wrong, nothing wrong. And as soon as she got her medical records, she looked and she saw the pattern. She was like, I'm premenopausal. That's what this is. I had no idea. And the doctor didn't have any idea, but I kept going back with these weird things. And she said, but then when I saw it all together on my medical records, I went, oh my God, it's so obvious. And so she created this in the brainstorming session, not in real life, but an AI thing to predict menopause based on those symptoms. So,
Yeah, I mean, that's the type of solution that we need in today's modern medical world, especially when so many women are having their concerns dismissed or their pain dismissed by their healthcare providers, or they just don't feel like they are able to go and have a conversation with their doctor.
Yeah, so true. And so what about data privacy with all of these AI? Because, you know, a lot of AI is personalized and there's a lot of data used. How is the privacy being handled in these situations?
Yeah, it's a fantastic question. I think it's one that, especially in the US, has not been prioritized. So especially when we think about, you know, the femtech applications in general, data privacy is a huge concern, especially given our, you know, post Roe versus Wade world with abortion. There's a huge fear that the reproductive health data or any type of health data from a female could be used against her potentially in order to actually prosecute her, or, you know, otherwise bring some type of a lawsuit against her for getting reproductive health care services. Yeah. So that's become a huge issue for women's health right now in the US. It's also led to women not necessarily trusting these algorithms and the devices that contain the algorithms because they aren't sure how their data will be used and how that could be disclosed downstream to a third party or another data broker. Yeah. So for that reason, especially in the US, it's a very, very sketchy environment right now, to be honest. You know, the ways that we could see this type of data being used against women could be disclosure to law enforcement, but we also see a lot of packaging and selling of data downstream to these data brokers, and also selling to Facebook or social media sites. And that's where it can get really concerning. There's actually an interesting article about a woman who was trying to keep her pregnancy a secret just to see how long she could actually do it, keep it secret from all of Facebook, right? All the social media advertisers. And despite her best intent, right? She never posted about it. She didn't buy things online about it. They still found out. And then they were still targeting her, you know, with advertisements or messaging related to her health condition. Yeah. So we don't have a very stringent recognition, right, or standard that the data being used for these algorithmic devices and algorithmic predictions is very sensitive and needs that heightened protection. We just don't have that type of a regulatory framework yet. And that leads to a lot of women being uncomfortable using those types of devices. You know, I think women aren't as uncomfortable whenever they use, you know, whenever AI is being used, let's say by a radiologist, right, or an oncologist, because we have the heightened data protections when it comes to data being disclosed to healthcare providers and in that medical setting. Yeah. But really in the US, we have that dichotomy where if it's in an app and that app isn't falling under the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, there's very little that governs health data.
Wow, that's interesting. It's also, it reminds me of a very long time ago about, well, probably before 2016 with Target in the US, there was that famous story because they use AI to make predictions about customers based on what they buy. Yes. And so then they can target customers with particular things because they've figured out from their buying patterns, what's going on. There was this really famous case where this father came in really angrily into the store and wanted to see the manager and spoke to him, said, you know, you're really inappropriately targeting my 16-year-old daughter with pregnancy ads and, you know, things like that. And they apologized. And, you know, then a few days later, he came back and apologized and said, actually, she is pregnant. Just no one knew. And they did, you know, basically, even if you don't buy anything to do with pregnancy, just the things you buy as a pregnant woman start to be very similar buying patterns. And so they can use the algorithms to predict conditions, all sorts of things based on buying patterns now.
Absolutely. And it's really crazy that we, you know, that we have the technology that can do that, yet we don't necessarily have the privacy protections that are going to safeguard women, right, from their finding out that they're pregnant, right, or, you know, a significant other finding out about a health condition. Yeah. There was a 2022 JMIR European Data Privacy Survey, and it looked at, you know, more than two dozen of the women's health apps that were out there, and it found that most of these apps were doing things like that behavioral tracking. More than 60%, right, were tracking user locations. More than 90% were sharing that data with third parties, and so it's absolutely not surprising that this data is finding its hands into those large corporations who can then target these individuals for monetary gain.
Yeah. And so what do you think the future is for data privacy for women's health?
You know, I'm seeing women step up and demand more data privacy protections than they've ever demanded in the past, which to me is very encouraging. You know, for all the things that unfortunately happened in the US with the Dobbs decision, this increased focus on data privacy has been at least something that's beneficial, and that it's really women are considering how much of their data they are willing to exchange for an algorithmic prediction, especially if it's something that might be like a period tracking app, right, where the trade-off may not necessarily be as great as something like a smart tampon, right, where you could get that life-changing insight versus something of mere convenience. So I think women are being smarter right now with their choices when we don't have that regulatory framework in place to protect data privacy. I think we're also seeing a movement towards consumers demanding more data privacy, especially for sensitive health data and reproductive health data. And they're demanding that of, you know, the femtech applications that are out there, along with the government. So in the US, for instance, we're seeing, you know, our Department of Health and Human Services coming out and trying to revise certain portions of HIPAA to better protect reproductive health data in this political climate. We're also seeing women, you know, who are demanding these, you know, new protections, moving away from certain applications that have lower privacy scores than other applications that might be more protective of privacy. Yeah. And in that way, especially for femtech and AI applications, privacy is really becoming a differentiator in a competitive way that it's never been before. So now it's making more sense, right, to invest the money up front in these data privacy protections because you can use it to your competitive advantage given everything that's happening in women's health.
Yeah.
So I think we're going to see movement towards better protecting women's healthcare data. I think we absolutely have to. Otherwise, there's a huge risk to the longevity and the viability of the femtech industry.
Yeah.
I think it's, you know, going to be slow as always. And I think we'll also see it start to trickle down into other areas of healthcare. For instance, mental health care apps, they're starting to get some attention too about their data privacy.
Yeah, yeah, that's interesting. Now you mentioned you worked with a lot of startups. And so one of the things that a lot of startups do is race to get to market. So how do those race to market strategies hurt both the consumers as well as the founders of those femtech digital health companies?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. So there's always, especially in the startup realm, right? You want to get to market, you want to start testing your product, you want to make sure that it's something that's viable, but you also want to start remaking the money that you've spent developing this product.
Yeah.
So especially if your product isn't subject to significant regulatory hurdles, there can be a real desire to kind of race to market with a prototype and then quote unquote, right, fix it as you go. The problem though that we're seeing is when companies do that, not only is their privacy and their security very, very lax, but also accuracy of the device can be a huge, huge concern. So this, you know, in the US, for instance, we see things like period tracking apps, right? Apps that provide, you know, minimal diagnostic tools, not something that's going into your body, right?
Yeah.
A lot of those apps are skirting by under enforcement discretion, meaning they're not having to do clinical trials. They're not having to prove their accuracy ratings or that they're safe or effective. That then results in products coming on the market that are not accurate and that actually don't further women's health care.
Yeah.
So the Organization for the Review of Care and Health Apps actually examined hundreds of apps that were in the femtech industry. So they looked at some of the most downloaded apps and they found that more than 85% of those apps did not meet their quality threshold and that they actually had some significant clinical assurance concerns. When we looked, there was a 2016 study by researchers at Columbia University Medical Center. They similarly found that about 95% of the 108 free smartphone menstrual cycle apps that they looked at were inaccurate and that they had absolutely no scientific grounding or any type of consultation with medical professionals.
Wow.
And that was similarly reaffirmed in a 2018 study that was conducted by Current Research and Opinion. And that study looked at 73 menstrual cycle apps, and it found that none of them, like zero of them, could accurately predict ovulation. And in fact, the app that had the best score had a 21% accuracy rating.
Oh my God.
So, right, and that's horrible in an industry that's built on empowering women and getting them to understand and learn their own bodies and, you know, improve women's health long term.
Yeah.
But we've got these devices that are being rushed to the market that aren't accurate, that aren't achieving any of their goals. And what it comes down to, right, is that those apps are then capitalizing on the $1 trillion opportunity that women's healthcare is representing.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a huge issue we have in femtech right now. You know, the other issue that we have is when we think about racing to market, we think about things like maybe we're not building code that is going to be as protected, right, or as secure against cyber hackers. So that's another thing. Mm-hmm. There have been studies that show that, you know, for every 1,000 lines of code, typically there's going to be somewhere between 10 to 50 errors in that code for every 1,000 lines. And we think about, you know, devices that can have millions of lines of code, that can open up a lot of vulnerabilities. Yet if founders are taking the time, right, and sourcing that code properly and making sure that it's done strategically and effectively, those error rates drop to maybe, you know, 1 to 5. So there's significant benefits from waiting, you know, from in terms of cybersecurity perspectives, in terms of accuracy, but also in terms of making sure that you are aligning with the market fit for your product. Yeah. I can't tell you how many times I see founders come and they launch a product and they think, great, this is it. This is exactly what my cohort needs. And then they start talking to people and they don't get any adoption of the product or very minimal adoption. And it's because that's not the solution that people want. Yeah. And so they had kind of a very wrong market fit that they didn't take time to address.
Yeah, I actually saw something last week that said the majority of failures of companies that don't really, they found and then they kind of fizzle out are because of wrong product for the market. So exactly.
And I hear a lot of people say, you know, oh, I've got to get this out because the market's going to be saturated, right? I've got to race to market before somebody else gets there before me. And what we're seeing because of that too, is just a lot of ideas that are, you know, very slightly iterative of each other, right? They're not very different. There's, you know, 100 period tracking apps, right?
Yeah.
We're not seeing that kind of next level innovation that needs to happen. So while, you know, the period tracking app market might be, you know, pretty saturated right now, the next level of innovation above that, that we can do with period tracking and with menstrual cycles hasn't even been touched.
Yeah.
But yet we're trying to capitalize so much on the monetary opportunity that's being presented and that's pretty new for women's health that I don't think that people are necessarily thinking about how to go above and beyond in that innovation when they actually could do so.
Yeah, which makes me wonder. So is FemTech achieving its goal of revolutionizing women's health, or is there kind of a darker side to the FemTech industry?
Yeah, it's another great question. You know, I think FemTech has succeeded so wonderfully in really giving voice to women's healthcare. You know, before 2016 and before coining the term FemTech, we didn't have a common dialogue to really discuss these new tech and digital health solutions for women. So that has really given us kind of a unified language and a unified voice to bring this to light. You know, I think FemTech does struggle in a couple of areas, though, that, you know, can prevent it from achieving its goals. We've talked about, you know, kind of the accuracy rates already. That's a huge one to me, because if women are trading their most valuable, sensitive health data for an algorithm that's not done accurately, or that's not going to be, you know, providing accurate or even actionable insights, what good is it, right? Are we violating women's trust in a way that we shouldn't be, or that wouldn't have happened if the FemTech market hadn't come to life? So that's really a key concern for me. You know, the other key concerns I have about, especially when we think about artificial intelligence, is women have been so long neglected from the modern mainstream health data sets and modern healthcare. And so a lot of times, right, the algorithm is only going to be as good as the data that it's trained on. Yet we have such a gender data gap when it comes to thinking about women's healthcare. We don't have a lot of female data points. And so I think that we have the risk for bias potentially in the way that algorithms are going to treat women going forward. You know, just because there is so much male data for healthcare out there and not as much for women.
Absolutely.
So I think that's kind of another thing to do. You know, the algorithms can, you know, propagate the biases that are present in the underlying data sets. So I think that we've really got to focus on building those female healthcare data sets in a way that we've never done so before. And that to me is going to require FemTech to move beyond the surface level where we're at right now, where we're thinking about menstruation and maternal health and ovulation and fertility. We've got to really push past that and build the meaningful data sets. And I don't think we're there yet. You know, I think we can get there, but I think it's going to take some sustained effort and also some sustained pushing to get there and get those data sets that we need that can then make AI much less biased, right? We'll have those data sets. The other thing is, you know, I think that there's, and I don't mean to pick on FemTech. I love FemTech, right? I am the biggest proponents of the industry. But I do think that there is a certain level of capitalizing on the monetary opportunity that's in FemTech. And so, you know, those companies are more inclined to share data with advertisers or data brokers than they are with research institutions who might be able to use those that data from to build some of these data sets that we need. So I think there's a lot of growth opportunity in FemTech, but I do think that we do kind of have this push and pull darker side a little bit that we need to kind of push back against.
Yeah, for sure. What do you think would be the top 3 to 5 mistakes that FemTech founders make?
Yeah, so there's a lot of mistakes, right, that the digital health founders make in general. You know, for FemTech, when we think about the emerging industry, one thing is obviously data privacy, as we've been talking about today. I don't think that a lot of, you know, depending on the companies, there are definitely companies doing it right out there. But you know, newer companies, I think, coming onto the market really need to be focused on embedding privacy by design into their products from the start, because it's much harder to add the privacy features at the end and regain consumer trust. Yeah. So even though it might require some investment up front in terms of, you know, monetary investment, tech investment, it's worth it to show that you're not just intending to capitalize on women's health data, but that you're actually committed to revolutionizing women's health and building these data sets that we need.
Yeah.
The second thing I would say is a lot of FemTech founders aren't thinking about scaling and potential partnerships and consolidation early enough. So there's a tendency to think about scaling after you've gotten your product on the market and it's ready to go, right? And you've made some money and you think, okay, where am I going to go next? I prefer to have companies think about scaling and potential partnerships as early as whenever they first launched, because how you set up your company really, it might be different if you're trying to attract investment from a certain group, right? They might want to see a certain corporate structure, or if you want to partner with a certain healthcare organization, they might require you to have certain security and privacy structures in place that if you wait until you're ready to partner with them, you might have to then pause that partnership and take 6 to 8 months to build that infrastructure.
Yeah.
You know, similarly, if you're trying to go into other jurisdictions, especially the US, we have a lovely healthcare regulatory landscape that is very complex and different than other parts of the world. And so you may have to substantially revamp your business model to come and do business in the US.
Yeah.
So I like to get founders to really think about scaling early enough. I also think one of the other things that we should really think about is, where can you partner, right? Is there somebody who's, you know, not doing the same thing, but maybe you're doing something related to menstruation and they're doing something related to fertility, and then somebody else is doing something related to maternal care? Is there a way to build a bigger comprehensive platform so that you're not just offering one solution?
Yeah.
That's something I've started to see kind of payers and other kind of healthcare partnership opportunities looking for, is not just, you know, one-off solutions, but really platforms that are more integrated and can provide care across multiple stages of a woman's life.
Yeah.
That's something we're not really talking about.
Yeah, yeah. You need that integrated customer journey, don't you?
Exactly. You really do. Mm-hmm. The other thing that we're starting to see, especially in the US, is these privacy policies, right? The promises that you're making to your consumers about how you're going to use their data.
Yeah.
We've seen those be broken. And we're seeing crackdowns, especially in the health tech industry, if those promises are broken and if you use data in a way that you say you won't use it.
Mm-hmm.
I see a lot of founders actually copying and pasting privacy policies in terms of use from other competitors. But the way that you use data is necessarily going to be different than the way your competitor does it. Even if you're doing the exact same product, right, you've got something that's very, very similar. How you use data, how you interact with your product and your patients, your customers, all of that is going to be different. And you've got to make sure that you have documents that are built for you, especially privacy policies, but also when we think about contract documents. I can't tell you how many times FemTech founders come to me and they say, okay, this is my baseline contract. Can you just take a quick look and make sure we're good? And I'll look at it and I'll say, well, these terms aren't favorable to you. You know, and oftentimes they've gotten a contract from a friend after it's been negotiated, or they found one online on a, you know, quick legal website, and they don't realize that a lot of times those documents aren't negotiated for them, right? They have post-negotiation terms that the parties have agreed to, but we're not talking about, you know, the starting position where they want to be, or they're missing things, you know, that then result in lawsuits or disputes later on.
Yeah.
So that's kind of another thing I always like to recommend, is really have a contract developed for you at the outset that you can use and feel confident with.
Yeah. And what about the trends? What would be the top trends in femtech that you're seeing?
Yeah. So the big one everybody's talking about right now is definitely menopause. That's really started to take off since about 2022. And part of that is due to the number of, celebrities now talking about menopause, but we're seeing a lot of growth, investment, and innovation really in menopause right now. The second is really that incorporation of AI, as we've been talking about today.
Yeah.
More and more platforms are kind of revamping to incorporate either an algorithm, AI, or some type of like chat GPT function. I've seen more and more companies do that and kind of relaunch, with these new features. So that's been really cool to watch. I expect that trend to definitely continue, especially with the innovations we're seeing in AI and chat GPT.
Yeah.
The other trend I would say is that we're definitely not there yet, but we're starting to move away from just viewing femtech as reproductive healthcare. And so we're seeing more solutions in the chronic care condition space and also in the cancer space, though not as much. And I think it's projected that, uterine and breast health and then in the future couple of years are going to kind of be the next wave that we see in femtech.
Okay. Yeah, interesting. And where do you see the future going then? So those are the trends. Where are we going from there?
Yeah, from there, I think one of the biggest concerns that we have is really building those data sets for women's health. Because right now, women's health is getting about 4% of research and development dollars from the healthcare spending. The problem is we need more. Right? Mm-hmm. We need a lot more money to bring these solutions to life.
Yeah.
But whenever women's health companies are going and they're pitching to investors, they're getting met with a lot of roadblocks, or they're trying to pitch to, payers or insurers to get these products covered. All of those, aspects of the industry want to see data. They want to have data proof, right? Here's going to be our return on investment. Here's how this is going to help, millions of women. Here's the data behind it. And we don't have that.
Yeah.
So I think that's going to be the next big frontier, really building those data sets, facilitating partnerships with femtech companies and researchers who can actually start to use that women's health data for long-term research projects that can substantially impact women's healthcare globally.
Yeah.
But I think that's got to be the next step. Otherwise, I think femtech, despite the fact that it is serving 50% of the world's population, it's always going to be seen as a niche market instead of a necessary market.
Yeah.
So if we can kind of shift our focus now to building those data sets, we'll have the data sets to convince payers, investors, everybody that we need to about the importance of women's health. And here's how it could, impact billions of dollars in the economy.
Yeah.
And I think we'll be in a much better position to drive sustained innovation where it's going to matter the most, which is going to be those chronic care conditions, longevity, cancer. That's where we've got to get to.
Yeah, very interesting. I have been at quite a few conferences recently, and I have met a lot of people working in female health drugs, so I'm in pharma. But if anyone who's listening, because you've got amazing insights, and you've got so much experience in this space. If there's anyone who's listening that wants to get in touch with you, what's the best way they can get in touch with you?
Absolutely. So you can visit our website at femminnovation.com. I am also very active on LinkedIn. You can find me on linkedin.com/in/BethanyCorbin. And then my own personal website is BethanyCorbin.com.
Oh, brilliant. So multiple ways.
Multiple ways, yes.
Well, thank you so much for your insights. It's been really, really interesting. And I think it's an area that's just going to start to grow. But as you say, we need the data and we need the privacy rules basically overhauled for sure. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of AI for Pharma Growth. If you have received huge value from this show, or maybe this episode has highlighted how you can use AI in your company, then we would love for you to support the show by leaving us a 5-star rating. Please make sure you hit the subscribe or follow button on your podcast app now to make sure you never miss an episode.